بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Good afternoon. The year of this conference, in honor of Professors William Chittick and Sachikar Morata, coincides with the 30-year death anniversary of one of their teachers, a man who was, without question, one of the most remarkable scholars of Islam and of Ibn Arabi to emerge out of the last century. Born in Tokyo in 1914, in his early adulthood, Izutsu gravitated towards the study of language and Greek philosophy. It was this appreciation for the music and for the magic of language that stirred in his heart a desire to learn Arabic, a wish later fulfilled when he met the enigmatic Sheikh Abdul Rashid Ibrahim in his early 20s. A Russian Tatar who traced his descent to Bukharans who had migrated to Western Siberia, Sheikh Ibrahim moved to Japan in the early 1930s. Having been imprisoned in the Russian Empire on more than one occasion for his anti-colonial pan-Islamic activities, Japan seemed like an ideal place of refuge. The nation had proven itself remarkably resilient in the 1904 and 1905 war with Russia. And the cultural and moral ethos of Japan in his eyes seemed to be deeply compatible with Islam. Having studied in Mecca, in Medina, in Istanbul, the man who had served as Qadi in his own country was no insignificant figure. Among Japanese journalists, he was sometimes introduced as the quote-unquote former president of the Muslims of Russia. Even though no such office existed, he held a prominent place in the eyes of his co-religionists. Conversant in Japanese, it was perhaps only natural that Sheikh Abdul Rashid Ibrahim would become the first imam of the Tokyo Mosque in Japan. Now, although Sheikh Ibrahim had initially declined the young Izutsu's request for a meeting, he eventually agreed, but stubbornly refused to teach him Arabic. When they met, the elderly gentleman said to him, holding an English biography of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in his hand, "Hada kitab ja'a min Amerika, afahimt?" This book has just arrived from America. Do you understand? Izutsu would later recall the quote-unquote tremendous thrill he felt on hearing classical Arabic. The excitement must have impressed itself on Sheikh Ibrahim, since he agreed to teach Izutsu, but on one condition: that he also learned the faith of the majority of those who speak it. Originally, the arrangement between them was for Izutsu to come once a week for lessons. Instead, he ended up attending almost every day. 2 years later, Izutsu had become so immersed in the universe of Islam that Sheikh Ibrahim could say to him, and I quote, "You are a natural born Muslim. Since you were a Muslim from the time of your birth, you are my son." Izutsu's wife, Toyoko, later described her husband's teacher as a quote-unquote engaging and affable man who had a penchant for proverbs. Sheikh Ibrahim died in exile in 1944 in his early 90s, in the same year as Izutsu's father. Toshihiko Izutsu began to write about Islam and related themes early in his life. His first major article came out in Japanese in 1939. It was on Arabic linguistics. A year later, Izutsu published another essay, this time on the ethics of the Mu'tazilite Quran commentator Az-Zamakhshari. Then, when Izutsu was only 27, he wrote his first book, entitled A History of Islamic Thought, or A History of Arabic Thought, rather, Islamic Theology and Philosophy. It was a survey of Islamic theology and thought up until Averroes. 5 years after the catastrophic events of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Izutsu became a professor at Keio University, an assistant professor. Then in 1952, when he was 38, he wrote a biography of the Prophet of Islam in Japanese. However, in the words of his biographer, Wakamutsu, this work, by Izutsu's own confession, was not, strictly speaking, a historical study, but it was rather a quote-unquote hymn of praise to his spiritual hero and a confession of his own inner thoughts. In the same year, he married Toyoko, the woman that would become his lifelong companion. From 1957 to 1958, he produced the first scholarly Japanese translation of the Quran directly from the Arabic. It was no doubt his painstaking analysis of the scripture that accompanied this task that would set the stage in 1959 for his first English book on Islam, The Structure of Ethical Terms in the Quran. This would lay the foundation for the development of a linguistic method of analyzing Muslim scripture and lead to the publication of God and man in the Quran, and then of the concept of belief in Islamic theology, a semantic analysis of Islam and Iman, or Iman and Islam. Along with ethical religious concepts of the Quran, which is a revised version of the earliest of the three books, Izutsu's studies of the language and worldview of Muslim revelation would establish him as an Islamicist of international stature, not to be ignored. In 1960, Izutsu visited McGill University, its Institute of Islamic Studies, which was established less than a decade earlier by Wilfred Campbell Smith, a pioneering Canadian scholar of comparative religion and of Islam. In 1962, Izutsu took up the position of a visiting professor at the Institute, traveling back and forth between Canada and Japan, until he was finally appointed full professor 7 years later. It was in 1962, upon attending a lecture by Sayyid Hussein Nasser, who, as you see in the image on the top right, is second from the left. It was upon attending this lecture in 1962 that an entirely new trajectory of thinking opened up to Izutsu. The talk that Nasser gave was on Mullah Sadra. It was a watershed moment for Izutsu, catalyzing a new phase of scholarship that would turn his attention to the later Islamic sapiential tradition. If Mullah Sadra was, historically speaking, the synthesizing point in whom a particular conception of existence was articulated that completely arrested the mind of Izutsu, then Ibn Arabi was its starting point. It was only natural that to adequately grasp Ibn Arabi's vision of reality, that Izutsu would have to begin with a careful, meticulous analysis of the Andalusian mystic. If we are to believe a widely circulated story at McGill, in order to better understand Ibn Arabi, Izutsu plunged into a three-month khalwa, or solitary retreat, where he would only read Ibn Arabi and do nothing else, with Toyoko bringing meals into his study so as not to interrupt the ascent of her husband's mind into the spiritual world of the great saint. The impact that this immersion into the Weltanschauung of arguably Islam's most important Sufi thinker cannot be underestimated. As Wakamutsu, Izutsu's biographer, wrote, had he not encountered the mystic philosopher, Izutsu's thought would likely have been completely different. In fact, Wakamutsu went so far as to state that Izutsu's own personal philosophy can be traced to a line of descent that stretches back to Ibn Arabi. While Izutsu was already familiar with the mystic before he came to Montreal, having published an essay on Ibn Arabi's ontology in Japanese in 1944, it was through his encounter with Nasser, and then 2 years later, Henry Corbin's student, Herman Landolt, who became a colleague of his in 1964, that Izutsu was able to tread into the universe of Ibn Arabi through a doorway that was quite different from that of conventional Western scholarship. There's no doubt that Nasser's lecture, where he would have outlined the significance of Ibn Arabi for Mullah Sadra, drawing on a living Persian Irfani tradition with which Nasser was in direct contact in Iran, would play an instrumental role in directing Izutsu to the Akbarian school. Izutsu had himself intuited beforehand the momentousness of this new phase of his intellectual life. When describing his move to McGill, he admitted that he was, and I quote his own words, urged on by what seemed to be an unstoppable existential impulse. The first significant fruit of this development appeared in 1966 with the publication of a two-volume study entitled A Comparative Study of Key Philosophical Concepts in Sufism and Taoism, later republished as Sufism and Taoism. While, as the title indicates, it was a comparative study, The section on Ibn Arabi alone, which is a good two-thirds of the study, was a full monograph in its own right. Along with Henry Corbin's creative imagination in the Sufism of Ibn Arabi, and the lengthy treatment of Ibn Arabi in Sayyid Hussein Nasr's Three Muslim Stages, these three works, Creative Imagination in the Sufism of Ibn Arabi, Three Muslim Stages, and Sufism and Taoism, would become the best introductions to Ibn Arabi so far in the West. In many ways, they complemented each other. Nasr presented a panoramic view of Ibn Arabi's life and thought. Henry Corbin focused on the significance of the Mundus Imaginalis, and Izutsu outlined Ibn Arabi's worldview with special attention to the Fusus and its later commentary tradition. If Corbin offered an inroad into Ibn Arabi through the Western tradition, or to be more precise, through what it had lost of the science of the Mundus Imaginalis, Izutsu did so through the Far East, through the inspired wisdom of Taoism. It would remain for Professor William Chittick, a student of these three great giants, to take Akbarian studies to new heights with his magisterial Sufi path of knowledge, Ibn al-Arabi's Metaphysics of Imagination, arguably the most utilized work in the field of Ibn Arabi studies. Sayyid Hussein Nasr observed that Izutsu had the rare gift of mastering the major languages of three major civilizations, Western civilization, Islamic civilization, and Far Eastern civilization. If anything, Sufism and Taoism, a study of Chinese and Arabic texts authored in English by a Japanese thinker, was a fitting illustration of this. By all accounts, Izutsu was a linguistic prodigy. There were rumors among students at Keio University that he knew 200 languages. When he was once asked how many he actually knew, he replied, 32, wryly adding, "But I make fewer mistakes in my Japanese." Surprisingly, in middle school, Izutsu was a poor student who hated English. But matters took a turn the day that he learned that, unlike Japanese, English distinguished between the singular and the plural. In a moment of awakening, it dawned on him that people who speak different languages might well experience the world differently. The simple insight stoked a thirst that was never quite quenched. To quote Izutsu, "The absurd notion kept running through my mind that I would master all the languages of the world, every single one of them. As a result of that momentary experience, I stepped into the scholarly world. The fascination of that mysterious thing called scholarship took hold of me as if in premonition of what lay ahead." Despite his fascination with and mastery of languages, at McGill, Izutsu was remembered for the aura he carried of an unassuming silent sage, distinguished, according to his colleague Herman Landolt, for his khamushi. And yet this silence could be colorfully interspersed with the sound of roaring laughter coming out of a classroom where he might be teaching. In the same year that Izutsu was appointed full professor at McGill, the university opened up its branch, or its Institute of Islamic Studies, in Tehran. Shortly thereafter, Sayyid Hussein Nasr invited him to join the teaching staff as a full-time member of the Iranian Academy of Philosophy, which Nasr had recently founded under the patronage of Queen Farah Pahlavi. Izutsu accepted, joining Corbin as part of its international faculty, where he would instruct courses on Islamic and Far Eastern philosophy. The Iranian years were for Izutsu a time of great productivity. Even as law and order began to break down with the unfolding of the early stages of the Iranian Revolution, Izutsu unremittingly continued his scholarly activities. When it became clear that it was too dangerous to remain, Izutsu boarded one of the last Japanese rescue missions and left Iran, never to return. Even though the decision was forced on him by circumstances outside of his control, he would later recount being free of the slightest feeling of regret, not because he had a personal wish to depart a nation for which he had grown fond, or because he had been treated badly by its people, but due to his belief in an ever-present power or agency that guides our lives, especially at key junctures separating different phases. Echoing the Islamic idea of tawakkul, of complete and total reliance in and trust in God. Izutsu had once even described himself as a fatalist. Had it not been for the tumultuous events that brought Imam Khomeini into power, it seems improbable that Izutsu would have bidden farewell to the country in the foreseeable future. On his return to Japan, Izutsu decided that he would now dedicate his intellectual energies to the elaboration of, quote-unquote, an Oriental philosophy, as he conceived it, primarily in Japanese. This philosophy was not, as it is sometimes misunderstood, that of the Far East, but of an Orient that included the realms of Islam, particularly Persia. To be clear, Izutsu recognized, before Columbia University's own Edward Said, that the so-called East was anything but a repository of a single unified vision of reality, a single Oriental essence. There is, to quote Izutsu, in the East, no uniformity. We can only speak of Eastern philosophies in the plural. However, he also felt there were deep conceptual overlaps that could allow for the development of a meta-philosophy of Eastern modes of thinking, one that could serve ultimately as a bridge between East and West, and beyond that, as a pathway for the articulation of a universal vision of reality. Within the confines of the Orient itself, Wahdat al-Wujud, or the unity of being, was crucial to the formulation of such a model. While he recognized the doctrine was simply one among others of a number of non-Western philosophies, he also felt that it had within it the resources for the development of an overarching meta-system or conceptual umbrella that could accommodate various other subsystems of Eastern thinking. If the fundamental structure of Wahdat al-Wujud could be adequately explained, it could, Izutsu felt, provide a basic conceptual model by which the majority of Oriental philosophies will be brought up to a certain level of structural uniformity concerning their most fundamental aspects. And here I'm quoting Izutsu directly. To be clear, Wahdat al-Wujud was for Izutsu not exclusive to Islam, but his deep study of the Quran, Arabic, Ibn Arabi, and the Islamic philosophical heritage allowed him to discern the presence of such a mode of thinking elsewhere. When Masataka observed about Izutsu that it was his long-term research in speculative philosophical Sufism which enabled him to discover a similar tradition in Buddhism, he was only partially correct. It allowed him to discover, in fact, similar traditions across the entire spiritual and philosophical landscape of the East. Now, it was also in his third phase, or the third phase of his life in Japan, that Izutsu began to develop an interest in postmodernism. He met Derrida, the late French denizen of deconstructionism, who penned a short essay for Izutsu entitled Letter to a Japanese Friend, where he provided some schematic reflections on his own terminology. Some, however, have made more of this interest than it warrants, because Izutsu was, if anything, a conventional postmodernist. In fact, the aspects of this outlook he was most attracted to were those that grew out of the years he spent meditating on the teachings of Ibn Arabi, an awareness of the relative nature of truth, the ineffability of the real, the limits of reason, and the mind's incapacity on its own to fully grasp reality. But Izutsu's understanding on these matters went far beyond anything postmodernism could offer, since he recognized not just relativity, but a relativity that was itself mysteriously plunged and an expression itself of what Meister Eckhart referred to as the ground of being. And this is why Izutsu would more accurately be described, as one modern writer has done, not as a postmodernist, but a post-postmodernist. Since beyond Maya's play of words and ideas, there lay an absolute reality which for him was the object of all human yearning and desire, the alpha and the omega of all that is, was, and could be. Izutsu was, in this respect, as far from an agnostic on metaphysics as one might imagine. The Japanese scholar sage passed away unexpectedly on the morning of January 7th, 1993, the consequence of a brain hemorrhage after a minor fall at home. But death, as the sage knew all too well, was far from the end. If one had prepared for it in the true mystical sense, through catharsis, tazkiyah, knowledge, inner illumination, and prayer, it was a liberation. as Izutsu had written years earlier in the Meditation on Human Mortality, in words that call to mind the famous couplet of the mystic martyr Al-Hallaj. And I quote Izutsu now, quote, "While the body lives, the spirit sinks down into the darkness of death. Therefore, so long as the body does not die, the spirit cannot live. Until one dies in the flesh, one cannot be reborn in the spirit. For a person to be able to live a life truly worthy of that name, the spirit must first be freed from the tomb of the flesh. As the tragedian Euripides says, who knows but that life be death, and that death be life? To be alive in this world is in fact to be dead. And to be dead in this world, conversely, is to be truly alive." Thank you.